comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, President Bush's whirlwind Asian tour. Other leaders talk the economy. The president talks terrorism.
Also, an American Christian general sneers at Islam as Malaysia's Islamic prime minister sees a Jewish conspiracy. Is religious polarization worse than ever?
And North Korea's dear leader, a complicated tyrant.
So his cruelty towards his own people is rather extreme. At the same time, and this is one of the even more curious things, Kim Jong-il himself, with visitors, is an incredibly charming, hospitable gentleman.
And an Irish journalist murdered for her reporting is featured in a new movie. We'll hear the real-life remembrance of a colleague.
These stories and more coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. A firefight in the central Iraqi city of Karbala has left three U.S. soldiers dead. A joint U.S.-Iraqi patrol was enforcing a curfew when they clashed with gunmen in what NPR's Deborah Amos tells us is one of Iraq's Shiite Muslim strongholds.
Karbala is a holy city for Iraq's Shia Muslims. There is a number of shrines in the city, and this clash took place outside of one of the holiest. Apparently what happened is there were a group of armed men outside of one of the clerics in the city's office. They were out after curfew. A joint patrol of Americans and Iraqis came upon them. There was firing, and this appears to have been a curfew issue.
NPR's Deborah Amos speaking to us from Baghdad. A spokesman for Central Command in Tampa, Florida, says the American soldiers were members of the 101st Airborne Division. In a separate incident, another American soldier was killed in Baghdad when a roadside bomb exploded. People with Alzheimer's disease will soon have access to a new drug. The Food and Drug Administration has approved memantine. It's the first medication to treat moderate and severe forms of the disease. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
Forest Laboratories said its new drug will arrive in pharmacies in January. The FDA's approval of memantine had been expected. Last month, scientific advisors to the FDA made a unanimous recommendation that it be approved for sale. But the panel members caution that the drug provides only minimal to modest relief. Still, for many people with moderate Alzheimer's, memantine seemed to delay the progression of the disease, and for some it led to small improvements in memory and thinking. The drug has been available in Germany since the mid-1980s. Now it's the first drug approved in this country to treat moderate and severe forms of Alzheimer's disease. It will sell under the brand name Namenda. Four other drugs are already available for people in the early stages of Alzheimer's. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
The head of the National Transportation Safety Board says investigators have learned more about the Staten Island ferry that crashed into a pier on Wednesday, killing 10 people and injuring dozens.
It was not speeding up, but we do have information about the speed of the vessel, and it was under what we say full speed at the time. It was not slowing down. It was going at a full speed.
Ellen Engelman appeared on ABC's Good Morning America. Investigators are examining what, if any, role the ferry's captain and crew played in the accident. President Bush had dinner in Tokyo with Japan's prime minister today. Mr. Bush praised the Japanese leader as a good friend and a strong leader. Stocks are trading lower this hour on Wall Street. The Dow is down 37 points to 97.54. The Nasdaq down 25 to 19.24. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, 500,000 commuters in and around Los Angeles scrambled for another way to and from work again today. The strike by 2,200 Metropolitan Transportation Authority mechanics is now in its third day. The workers walked off the job on Tuesday, and some 6,000 drivers and train operators are honoring the picket lines. A labor spokesman says the talks are progressing slowly. Builders continued putting up new homes last month. The Commerce Department reports construction of new single-family homes and apartment buildings hit its second highest level of the year, despite rising interest rates. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Mortgage rates may be off their lows of the year, going from just over 5.25% in June to back above 6%. However, that does not appear to have put a huge crimp in the housing market. According to the Commerce Department, construction of new homes and apartments rose in every part of the country except the South last month. Housing starts were up 3.4%, rising to a seasonally adjusted level of just under 1.9 million units. That's behind only the big increase in new home building in July, which was at a 17-year high. A slight dip in mortgage interest rates last month may have helped boost construction as builders rushed to complete projects ahead of rising rates. However, applications for new home building, often seen as a gauge of future activity in the housing market, were down last month, declining 2.2%. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Miami is putting in a bid to become the permanent site of the future free trade area of the Americas. The winning city would be the headquarters for a pending trade accord being developed among 34 nations. Atlanta is also competing for the center, along with cities in Mexico, Panama, Trinidad, and Tobago. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush kicked off his six-day tour of Asia today, meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi in Tokyo. Also in Tokyo, a few dozen protesters marching in front of the U.S. Embassy, condemning Japan's plan to help rebuild Iraq. Mr. Bush heads to Bangkok this weekend for the annual meeting of Asian and Pacific nations. Joining us on the line from Tokyo is Los Angeles Times reporter Maura Reynolds. And Maura, what did the president talk about today with the prime minister?
Well, they talked about quite a few things. The main one on the U.S. agenda, of course, was Iraq and Japan's promise to provide financial assistance for the Iraqi reconstruction and possibly troops sometime in the future.
Is there a sense that yesterday's UN vote accepting the U.S. resolution might have moved that contribution along?
Oh, absolutely. I think the administration is quite pleased with the vote, and they feel that they really have the imprimatur of the UN now as they head towards APEC and visiting these other countries. Many countries, both in Europe and in Asia, have said that they would be willing to contribute troops only if they had a UN resolution authorizing it, and they have that now. So Bush can press his case much harder than I think he could have just a few days ago.
Well, President Bush goes to the Philippines next. What other topics are on his agenda while in Asia?
On the top of his agenda really is terrorism and Iraq. The Bush administration has described Asia as being the second front in the war on terror, Iraq being the first, and that means that these nations are very important to the administration's plans for dealing with what they consider a terrorist threat to the United States.
Well, we understand that while the president is stressing terrorism and security, many of the countries he's visiting think that trade and a better economy is the way to better security.
The Bush administration have their own spin on that. Bush says that he plans to talk about what he calls economic security when he's at the APEC meeting in Bangkok. What he means by that is that without security, economies can't prosper. And he holds up Indonesia as an example of that, that the tourism industry, which is quite important to that nation, has really suffered quite a blow in the wake of the Bali bombing.
Yeah. And do I understand that some of the countries he's visiting are saying, well, more open markets, better trade agreements are the way to better jobs and less terrorism?
They are saying that, and that's essentially where the distinction is between the administration and many foreign allies, that the administration tends to concentrate on law enforcement as a way to combat terrorism, and some of our allies believe that encouraging prosperity and democracy in third world countries and places with authoritarian governments is a better way to dig out the roots of terrorism.
Well, Maura, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is a Los Angeles Times reporter. She spoke to us from Tokyo.
No country at this weekend's economic conference in Bangkok is growing more rapidly than China. 9.1% growth in the last quarter. More money in the purse and pocket. That's transforming Chinese consumers. As our next guest recently wrote, today China is about supply. tomorrow it will be about demand. We're joined now by Stephen Roach, chief economist for Morgan Stanley. He's in New York, and welcome, Stephen.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks so much. So, Stephen Roach, I read in a dispatch just this morning that in 7 years, there will be more personal computers sold in China than in the United States. General Motors is offering a broad line of cars now, from Chevrolets to Cadillacs, to the Chinese market. Whatever happened to the Chinese citizen chained to an iron rice bowl and wearing a Mao jacket?
This is the way China's going down the path of reform. First, they become producers, and then as their workers start to earn money, they begin to be able to afford consumable goods that we and others will sell them. Ultimately, the end game for the rest of the world is that China joins us as consumers.
And they like American products, don't they? They like the really good stuff. I read in one dispatch a Chinese businessman saying, I don't want these Taiwanese computers anymore. I want a good American Dell. They've got expensive tastes.
Chinese consumers are sophisticated. They do appreciate quality. They do like American brand. And there's widespread acceptance that high-quality Western-made goods are synonymous with increased perceptions of prosperity and improved lifestyles.
So is this very good news for the American economy, that the Chinese will more and more begin to soak up imports from the U.S., shifting around that huge trade deficit we now have with them?
Yes, I think that the development and transformation of the Chinese economy is a huge plus for China, for the United States and the broader world economy. And our politicians in Washington that are now bashing China because of what they have done in creating a very reckless fiscal policy in the U.S. Are really turning China into a scapegoat. And that's the wrong thing to do, especially at this point in time. But it's just part of political posturing that always comes in an election year in America.
Stephen Roach, is there any downside to Chinese consumers buying more and more Western / U.S. goods?
Look, China is the largest country in the world in terms of population. A fourth of the world lives in China. And if China goes through the type of reform and transformation that I envision, it could be the biggest plus for the global economy in this century.
Stephen Roach, chief economist at Morgan Stanley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
With the Middle East peace process seemingly dead, and recent World Trade Organization talks having collapsed, and the war between Islamic terrorism and the West nowhere near an end, the world seems more polarized than at any time since the Cold War, politically, economically, and religiously. Two recent examples. The American general charged with capturing Osama bin Laden is a born-again Christian who's called the Muslim God an idol and boasted that our God is bigger than their God. And this week, the Islamic Prime Minister of Malaysia told a summit of Islamic leaders that Jews control the world. Well, joining us now to discuss religious polarization is Professor Omid Safi, who teaches Islamic studies and comparative religion at Colgate University. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Professor Safi, let's start with those remarks made recently by American Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, the man in charge of the hunt for Osama bin Laden. What message does it send to the Muslim world when a military officer says that God put George Bush into the White House and that the enemy is, he said, Satan?
Well, this kind of statement is one that we have been hearing quite a bit of in the past few years. You can go back and listen to the statements made by Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. You can go back to Franklin Graham talking about Islam as an evil and wicked religion. But what makes this particular statement so disturbing is the fact that it does come from someone who has been designated to serve in a very high-ranking, visible military position. So it's actually the juxtaposition of an evangelical prejudice against Islam with an arrogant militarism.
And this gets out in the Islamic world, doesn't it? This will be in their newspapers.
Oh, this particular story and those set of quotations have already been circulated. And what it does, unfortunately, is to confirm the worst suspicions that Muslims, both in the traditional part of the Islamic world and also, frankly, here in the United States, have about the the supposed clash of civilization agenda or some kind of a crusade mentality on the behalf of the Bush administration. It's one thing for a minister to get up and say something like this, as some ministers have. It's another thing for a person to get up there in full military regalia, as Boykin does, and repeat such statements. Words carry a tremendous amount of power in this age of globalism, where people are reading what each other are saying very, very closely. And I think if we are trying to move to some kind of a more pluralistic engagement at a global level, then these kinds of statements do nothing but impede that.
Let's turn to Malaysia.
Yeah.
What was the reaction when Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad told a summit of leaders that Jews control the world?
Well, interestingly enough, the immediate response to his presentation is very different from how that statement was received here in the United States. The immediate response was that they all got up and they clapped for him. But that was because his comment about Jews taking over the world and having invented human rights and democracy and communism and socialism, obviously an absurd assertion, was couched in a much longer set of conversations about the need for Muslims to adopt nonviolent means and to engage science and technology. And then he tapped into what is clearly the moral issue for Muslims over the world today, which is the ongoing oppression of Palestinians. Mm. When he did that, people identified with him. And in that sense, I think he was trying to use the pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli sentiment that is very widespread across the Muslim world to bring about a sense of unity. Mm. Now, the question that one could ask is, certainly it is possible, some would even say necessary, to condemn the acts of aggression committed by the Israeli military, and I would add also by the Palestinian suicide bombers. The question is there a way of bringing about unity that does not work through demonizing another block of humanity? In order to bring about a greater sense of the us, do we have to slam some group called the them?
Yet it's always happened, hasn't it, through history? Are we any more polarized now religiously than we've ever been?
My sense is that actually there is, you hear this term of clash of civilizations very much being tossed around these days, and there are some very prominent people, academics and policymakers, who buy into this notion that there is a fundamental clash between Islam and the West. I actually radically disagree with that notion. My sense is that while there is a kind of splitting going on in the world, it is actually much more internal to each one of those composites. So there's a radical disagreement among Christians who may operate in a kind of evangelical way that you're seeing General Boykin operate, and more pluralistic Christians who seek to establish bridges of understanding with Muslims and Jews and homosexuals and others. Mm-hmm. Likewise, on the Islamic side, I think that there are progressive Muslims who are seeking to bring about a humanist, pluralist, gender-equal message and interpretation of Islam, and they are at odds with their own co-religionists who adopt a more exclusivistic message. So in some ways, and ironically, I think it's more likely for a progressive Christian to find something in common with a progressive Muslim than either one of those two are likely to find in common with the more exclusivistic co-religionists.
Hmm. Professor Omid Safi teaches Islamic studies and comparative religion at Colgate University. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Just ahead, insight into a broken country's dear leader, North Korea's Kim Jong-il.
And later in the program, a journalist's very personal remembrance of a murdered colleague's coverage.
There's more coming up here and now.
junk gets pounded. Uh-oh. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
When President Bush joins Asian leaders for the economic summit in Bangkok this weekend, one who won't be there is North Korea's Kim Jong-il. He rarely travels abroad, and when he does, it tends to be in a bizarre style, as in his 2001 journey across Russia in an armored railway car. Kim Jong-il has often been described as a drunken buffoon with a penchant for Hollywood movies and young women. At one point, he combined all three traits, ordering a South Korean film star to be kidnapped, hoping she would improve the North Korean film industry. But in a profile in the coming New York Times Sunday magazine, journalist Peter Maas says the North Korean dictator works relentlessly to keep himself in power and the U.S. on its toes. Peter Maas joins us now on the line from New York. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Do me a favor. There's so many things that you lay out in your article. Just those odd little eccentric maybe facts that we know about the great, the dear leader. Can you just tick off some for us?
Sure. Well, he's really very much of a workaholic. He's not kind of a lazy slob who just sits around watching movies all the time. He only sleeps about 4 hours a night. He watches TV quite frequently, and that's not just South Korean TV. That's also Chinese TV, Russian TV, and also CNN. As well, he has several computers in his office, and when he met Madeleine Albright in 2000, when he said farewell to her, that one of the last things he said to her was, could you please give me an email address? Mm-hmm. So in addition to being something of a workaholic, he also is a man who actually knows quite a bit about the world around him.
And his books on the opera, for instance, are on sale on Amazon.com.
Yeah, exactly. There's a book that he wrote about the opera, and there's also a book on criticism of the cinema that he also wrote, or at least that he's given credit for authoring. He is, of course, a movie buff, and one of the things that he did when he met with Albright was to talk about the movies, and he asked her what she had seen most recently, and she said she had seen Gladiator, and he responded by saying he had just seen Amistad. Mm.
You describe his dictatorship as something that mixes high technology with Confucian traditions, a kind of cyber feudalism. It's the oddest comparison, but how does he compare with other dictators?
He's really unusual in this combination of being, in fact, on top of a nuclear power, undeclared though it is, and at the same time being from an incredibly traditional style of leadership, as well as, of course, of being on top of an insular nation over which he presides. And there is, of course, a very large gulag for political prisoners and just ordinary North Koreans who have displeased or seem to have insufficient loyalty to the regime. So his cruelty towards his own people is rather extreme, extremer than even Saddam Hussein's was. At the same time, and this is one of the even more curious things, Kim Jong-il himself, with visitors, is an incredibly charming, hospitable gentleman. You get the impression, I talked to a lot of people who met him, that they liked Kim Jong-il because he was very friendly, he told a lot of jokes, he was extremely solicitous. He's a very, very unusual character.
Yeah, and yet, as you write, not crazy, for instance, like Idi Amin. So with all that you know, where do you think he's going to go on, let's say, the most important question, the nuclear question?
Well, I think it's clear to me, at least, and to a lot of the people that I've spoken with, and that includes people who are defectors from North Korea, that Kim Jong-il is very unlikely to ever give up all of the nuclear weapons and the nuclear programs that he has, because that's the only bargaining chip that he has. I mean, he does have a fear, and it's probably a legitimate one, of being invaded or attacked by the United States, which, as we all know, has attacked two countries in the last couple of years. And if he did not have these nuclear weapons or the threat of nuclear weapons, he'd be much more vulnerable to attack. So maybe he'd be willing, I imagine, to perhaps allow some limited inspections in return for favors from the West and from South Korea and China. But to give up everything that he's got would be to lay himself absolutely bare to attack from the United States or its allies. And that's something that anybody in his position would be very loath to do.
Yeah. What is the chance that any change might come from within?
Well, I think that's the only way change will happen. I mean, the United States, I don't think, is going to invade North Korea, if only because of the threat of nuclear attack in retribution. Neither, of course, is China. So the only kind of change that's going to happen is going to have to be from within. That's one of the things that At the moment, however, it's really unforeseeable how that will happen. But again, hard to imagine the situation staying the same for here to eternity.
Peter Maas, if you had one opportunity to ask one question of Kim Jong-il, North Korean dictator, what would it be?
Who do you think you are?
Do you mean?
You know, the thing is, I've talked with dictators before. I've interviewed more than enough. And you can ask whatever question you want, and you never get the direct answer that the question seeks. And, you know, one of the disadvantages of doing a profile of Kim Jong-il is that, A, I couldn't go to North Korea, and B, obviously I couldn't talk to Kim Jong-il. No Western journalist ever has or ever will, I imagine. But it's not as great a disadvantage as you think, because when you meet these men, they don't tell you the truth. Yeah. They don't give you honest answers unless the truth happens to be useful to them, which is rarely the case. And so the virtue of being able to ask Kim Jong-il a question, or the virtue of being able to ask any dictator a question, though entertaining and exciting, it doesn't get you what you need or where you want to go.
Well, some would say the same of American politicians, but I take your point. I just, when you say your question would be, who do you think you are, do you mean it in the, who do you think you are, or seriously, who do you think you are?
I mean it in the first sense, in the sense of who do you think you are to enslave a nation, to have led it into a preventable famine in which about 2 million people, if not more, were killed, to preside over a gulag, to preside over executions, to be responsible for the largest and longest running human rights abuse of the 20th century, with the exception perhaps of Nazi Germany. Who do you think you are to do this?
Well, Peter Maas, if you ever get to ask that question and then get out of the country, please let us know.
Will do.
Peter Maas, thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Maas's profile of Korean dictator Kim Jong-il appears in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, it will be the Yankees versus the Marlins in the World Series, but Red Sox fans do have some bragging rights. When our team loses, it's spectacular.
And the new film, Pieces of April. The setting is a Thanksgiving dinner with an extra-large serving of family dysfunction.
Turkey, mashed potatoes, of course, and all cranberry sauce, which is easy. Just open the can.
Yvette.
Oh, sweetie. I like it from the can.
Nobody likes it from the can.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. It's been another violent day in Iraq. Three U.S. soldiers were killed in a deadly overnight fight in Karbala. Lourdes Navarro reports.
Three U.S. military policemen from the 101st Airborne are dead and seven others wounded after a clash with Shiite militiamen overnight in the holy city of Karbala. At least 10 Iraqis were also killed. According to one witness, a patrol was trying to get a group of armed men guarding the headquarters of a Shiite cleric off the street after the 9 p.m. curfew. The gunmen refused and fighting ensued. Karbala has been the scene of a number of incidents in recent weeks as different Shiite factions battle for power. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, another soldier was killed and two more injured when a roadside bomb exploded. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
The Staten Island ferry that crashed on Wednesday, killing 10 people, was at full throttle when it hit the pier. That's according to a federal investigator who spoke with ABC's Good Morning America today. The ferry's pilot remains hospitalized in critical condition and under police guard following an apparent suicide attempt. A law enforcement source tells the Associated Press that early blood test results indicate alcohol was not a factor in the crash and that investigators are examining what, if any, role prescription drugs might have played in the accident. Jury selection continues into a fourth day in the case of sniper suspect John Muhammad. Another potential juror has been rejected. The unidentified woman had said that she feared for herself and her friends who lived in the Washington area during the sniper attacks 1 year ago. An earthquake in China has left at least three people dead and nearly three dozen injured. China's official news agency reports that the 6.1 magnitude quake struck China's mountainous southwest at around 8:30 p.m. last night. There, just 3 months ago, a quake in the same area killed at least 15 people and injured close to 300. A new study finds the taller you are, the more money you make. Researchers at the University of Florida and North Carolina found that tall people tend to make more money and win more respect at work. Timothy Judge, co-author of the Height Income Study, says every inch can be worth nearly $800 in extra income a year.
A person who is 7 inches taller than another individual would earn $5,500 more per year. Well, if you compound that over a 30-year career, that is hundreds of thousands of dollars of earnings advantages enjoyed by tall people.
On Wall Street, midday stocks are down. The Dow is down 41 points at 97.51. 33 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
I'm fine. I'm really fine. I just need a hug. Red Sox management had to paint over the World Series logo that they had just painted on the Fenway Park lawn last night when the Sox suddenly fell. What were we thinking? Oh, that's right. We were thinking we might win. Sports coverage, and the field of broken dreams. That's the topic we're putting before our editorial roundtable today. Joining us on the line, Tom Moroney, columnist for the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Robin. Condolences.
I had a colleague come in today and just say to me, I feel like I can never love again. We're also joined by Harvey Aratton. He's a sports columnist for the New York Times. Welcome, Harvey, and congratulations.
Well, I'm not to be congratulated. I'm a neutral observer.
Oh, please. You're in New York. Harvey, can you get a sense of how New Yorkers are feeling today? And do they really, I mean, here in Boston, we have this feeling that in New York you don't need this, you don't want it as much.
Well, I guess today New Yorkers feel, they woke up and felt, at least the Yankee fans did, that, you know, it happened on cue, almost as if it were to be expected. But the reality is that people here were very, very scared. They were afraid of Pedro Martinez.
And fans in Boston now realize that they had to be a little scared of Red Sox manager Grady Little. He made a decision to leave Pedro in maybe a little too long, Tom?
Well, that is going to be the key today on every sports talk show here in Boston. I believe the manager is going to be summarily croaked. Now, when that happened last night, I have to tell you, Robin, I almost stood up and gave him a single ovation here in my living room because I thought it was a gutsy move, and I thought it was classy, and I thought, you know, Pedro can do this. Pedro gave him such a look of – he nodded in the affirmative in such a strong – and
it was drama.
Yeah, and I thought, wow, you know, this is the storybook ending.
Okay, that was the first time. What about the second time you let him in?
Then I was just angry as hell.
Yeah. Harvey, in New York View again. How fun is it for writers to write about the Boston Red Sox and the Chicago Cubs, and how much are they going to be missing from your sports pages?
Well, I think the Red Sox and the Cubs are both stories that resonate nationally, and I think obviously that could be seen by the size of the ratings, the national television ratings. But I would also, you know, from the national baseball point of view, make the argument that it's probably better for baseball that the teams didn't win, the Cubs and the Red Sox didn't win.
You know, I want to pick up.
Because the story continues, the quest continues.
Right. Well, you know, I want to pick up on that point, Harvey. I mean, HBO did The Curse of the Bambino. There was a point in that film where they talk to Red Sox fans about that very point. What if you do win it all? And there was this look of absolute befuddlement on the faces of the fans.
Right. Remember Tom Stephen, right? The comedian even said, I don't know, it's like trying to picture infinity.
The right word is quest. And when the quest is over, there are a lot of people looking around, scratching their heads, saying, now what do we do?
Right. Well, and I think it's going to be, as you were sort of alluding to, Harvey, better for sports writers, too, because you get more to write about. Hey, speaking of sports writers and what you write about, a couple quick journalistic questions about coverage of the playoffs. Should the Chicago Sun-Times have named the fan, before the fan outed himself, the fan who botched the catch in Game 6 of the Cubs-Marlins series on Tuesday? Now his face is on wanted posters around the city. Harvey?
Well, you know, perhaps you could make the argument that it was inevitable that the guy's name would get out there. But I thought the initial reaction in Chicago was disgraceful on the part of the fans and, to a certain extent, the media as well. I mean, there were several columns in the Chicago papers the following morning castigating this guy, you know, basically saying he deserved all the abuse that he got. I can understand the level of frustration, but we're talking about a human being here. And, you know, the point I wanted to make was that you start making people feel they have a right to take their passions out on another fan for getting in the way or whatever, and the next thing you know is you have people feeling like they can, you know, make death threats against Kobe Bryant's accuser because she got in the way of Lakers winning another championship.
You know, I would agree with all that, except let's get to the technical point here. You know, a lot of journalists say they hang their hat on the idea that if the police name someone, then we have the perfect right to put them in the paper. And I've got to tell you, I come down on the side that, yes, put his name in the paper. If you find out who he is, you put him in there. Does he deserve the ridicule and the threats? No. But the fact is, naming him was in the public interest.
How was it in the public interest?
Because he was a very important part of this high drama. It's something people wanted to know, Robin.
Tom, I think you were up too late last night.
My feeling is that I don't know what purpose it serves to
because
know who
it
he
makes
is
him
and,
real
and where he works.
It what makes him real, Harvey. If we are going to start making those kind of decisions, then I'm afraid we're down a slippery slope. Yeah, that's all I'm worried about.
You know what I'm thinking? That we're having sort of a replay of the eighth inning here between a New Yorker. And no, it's great. It's fine. Hey, Harvey, but I want to turn to a far more serious disclosure now that also happened this week. At the Kobe Bryant rape trial, his lawyers brought up all sorts of details about the alleged victim's sex life, and even named her several times. The lawyer did, a female lawyer did, and kind of apologized, saying she forgot. What's happening there, Tom?
Well, I think you are seeing a replay of a lot of the bad habits and a lot of the things that we always worry about in these cases, and that is trying the victim or the alleged victim. They're going to try the alleged victim here, and it's wrong, and they should be upbraided when that happens. And I just don't like to see it. It's just it's terrible. I am so turned off, by the way. When I see a Kobe Bryant story on TV or an update on the radio, I just don't want to hear it. I turn it off.
And going back to our original topic, many New Englanders will also be turning off the World Series. Are you going to watch it all, Tom?
Maybe a little bit. I asked my editor if I could go to Florida. This was before last night's game because I wanted to go down and see where the Red Sox would be playing, Robin. But that's not going to happen now.
And, Harvey, we here at Sports Radio in Boston, we're getting calls from Indonesia, calls of sympathy. People got in their cars during the game last night and drove from New Jersey. It's a five-hour drive to Boston to celebrate with Red Sox fans. I'm wondering, do Red Sox sports writers have more interesting stuff to write about today in the loss than potentially you do in a win?
Well, I think for a day or two they do. You know, what you feel is more interesting. I do think that, you know, the Yankees, this particular Yankee team from 96 on has been a tremendous story. Those players have written their own great stories. You know, Jeter, Bernie Williams, and Jorge Posada got huge hits against Pedro Martinez to bail the Yankees out last night.
Stop saying those names, Harvey. I think we have to stop now. It's been a pleasure sort of talking to you. We really appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Tom, I hope you get to take a nap today.
Well, I wish you some rest too, Robin. And remember, please remember.
Don't say wait till next year, please.
Well, you said it.
Okay. Harvey Araton, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Harvey Araton, sports columnist for the New York Times. Tom Maroney, columnist for the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. Members of our weekly editorial roundtable.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our interview with Michael Newdow, the California father who says the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance violates the mandate of separation between church and state, prompted Jeff Tichenol of Allentown, Pennsylvania, to note that a reference to God was included in the Magna Carta to ensure separation of church and state. And he writes, 800 years later, this phrase is needed more than ever. Not because religion is needed in government, but because our leaders need to be humbled and reminded that they, too, are not above the rule of law.
Our interview yesterday with the attorney representing Tommy Chong, who's serving a sentence for selling bongs, brought this response from David Rice. Chong's attorney implied that he was being unfairly persecuted because of the celebrity of a character he played in the movies 25 years ago. I would argue that his fame is the only thing that turns a simple case of breaking the law into a discussion about whether or not the law makes sense. If Chong was a neo-Nazi selling bongs on the internet, no one would question whether or not the law should apply to him simply because it hadn't been used in a while.
Last week, while reporting on President Bush's visit to New Hampshire, we said that polls show that the president has a great deal of support in the Granite State, which prompted Jen Doan to call.
To say that people in New Hampshire are supporting Bush is so far wrong. I just am really irritated that NPR is just saying things like that when it's absolutely not true. Some people are supporting Bush, but a lot of people in New Hampshire are not.
Yesterday, we spoke with a teacher from Marblehead, Massachusetts, whose students wrote songs about loving the Red Sox and one about hating the Yankees. Joanne Bickford from New England took exception.
The word hate and the teaching of hate, I don't care if it's whatever it's about, should not be mentioned in our public school systems today with what's going on in the world. Hating the Yankees, the Red Sox, the who cares. The word hate in my household is not even allowed to be mentioned.
And finally, a lot of response to Robin's essay on Bruce Springsteen getting booed at his recent Shea Stadium concert. Matt Murphy, a cop in Massachusetts, wrote that he's one of the fans who doesn't like Bruce's song about a police shooting. He adds, Springsteen now seems willing to use his stage as a pulpit for his politics. This is fine, of course, but the country is just too fractured, scared, and anxious right now. Anyway, I thought Robin did a great job describing the mini-America she encountered at Shea.
Well, thank you. Listener Mark Walczak wrote, "Shut up and play seems to be a mantra heard all across America now. Even fans who ought to know better turn out at Springsteen concerts longing for patriotic rock anthems."
And one last note.
When I was younger, so much younger than today.
Mark Stevenson of Tucson, Arizona, correctly points out the Beatles played Shea in 65 and 66, not Robin, 1963.
I know. I was at both, but those 60s all start to run together.
It all blurs, but boy, I wish I could say I'd been at both. Anyway, as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Help me get my feet back on the ground. Won't you please help me?
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Investigative journalism can be deadly. Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl was brutally killed in 2002 by Islamic extremists in Pakistan. And now there's a new film about a case less familiar to many Americans. Irish reporter Veronica Guerin, who was murdered in 1996 for her coverage of Dublin's criminal underworld. The movie's called Veronica Guerin.
I'm a reporter. I'm supposed to be writing about things that matter. I have a great life. I have a great family. But I feel like I should be making a difference.
The movie opens in theaters today, and we thought we'd turn to someone who knew Veronica Guerin. Joining us on the line now is Boston Globe reporter Kevin Cullen. Hi, Kev.
Hi, Bill.
Kevin, can you draw a quick sketch for us of Veronica Guerin, who you knew? Who would you meet if you met her?
Well, Veronica was trained as an accountant and didn't even get into journalism until she was 30. But she brought this incredible enthusiasm. She was, I would say, the ultimate schmoozer. I mean, I remember first time I met her, I thought she should be a politician because she was so personable. And the first conversation I had with her was about Manchester United, the football, the English soccer team, which she was mad about. And that was the kind of thing, she could talk to anybody, and she had common themes, and football being one of, English football being one of them. She just was an extraordinary personality, and that's what made her a good reporter, even though she had no background in journalism when she got into it.
Well, Kev, by 1994, the windows of Guerin's home had been shot out because of her investigations of the underworld. In 1995, she publishes a piece about a criminal called the Monk, and she's shot in the thigh. Her six-year-old son is then threatened, and she doesn't back off. What did you tell her when she was going through all this?
I actually talked to her a couple of weeks or maybe a month after she was shot. I was in Dublin doing some work. And I, like many other people, suggested, you know, it was probably time for her to move on. She would have been a great political correspondent, and frankly, there was a greater need for political coverage of the corruption in Ireland than there probably was of the crime coverage that she had specialized in. But she was so invested in this personally that she could not be seen as giving in to these guys.
The Irish Independent, which she worked for, did give her 24-hour security. But in June of 1996, two men on a motorcycle fired six rounds from a pistol and killed Veronica Guerin. You've seen the movie. What did you think of it?
Well, it kind of brought, I must say I was surprised my reaction. I was really upset personally because as I sat in the theater the other night, I don't think Veronica should be dead. I really don't believe that she should have been on that story. She should have been on another beat. And I really think that as I watched that, I got extremely upset because I look back and I just wonder if, you know, why her bosses just didn't say, you know you want to stay on this story, but we have a greater responsibility here. You're too close to it. People have tried to kill you, and you've got to move on. And that's when I came away from the film. I mean, it's brilliantly done. Cate Blanchett nails Veronica. She sounds like her. She looks like her. The movie captures the sort of venality of these gangsters in Dublin. But, you know, the other thing is the film talked about how much things had improved since Veronica died, and I don't accept that. Dublin's got a worse drug problem now than it did when Veronica was killed. I just was overwhelmed with sadness watching this film, and just like I said, I keep coming back to the point that Veronica should not be dead.
Kevin Cullen, thanks very much for joining us on this.
Thank you.
Boston Globe reporter Kevin Cullen on the life and murder of courageous investigative reporter Veronica Guerin.
Thanksgiving is over a month away, but members of some families are already breaking out in a cold sweat. Dysfunctional families for whom an annual reunion around a turkey is torture. In the new film Pieces of April, April, played by Katie Holmes, is desperately trying to make Thanksgiving dinner, and her family has so little faith in her abilities, they make a pit stop at a Krispy Kreme donut store on the way to her apartment.
I'll have a vanilla-covered cream filled, please.
Can I get two chocolate ice? Can you hold on just a second?
They have donuts.
Remember, everybody, April is cooking.
We'll need an extra dozen glazed.
That last voice, April's dying, mean-spirited mother. A dying mother, a dysfunctional family, a lousy Thanksgiving dinner, and guess what else? It's supposed to be a comedy. Pieces of April opens in New York and L.A. today and nationwide next Friday. We're joined now by Here and Now's film critic Renee Graham. And Renee, director Peter Hedges hopes that hilarity ensues. Does it?
Hilarity does not quite ensue. There are humorous moments, but I wouldn't really characterize this as a comedy.
Although the director, in some ways, does. Tell us a little more about the plot.
The main character is April, played by Katie Holmes, and she's invited her family, from whom she's somewhat estranged, to spend Thanksgiving dinner with her and her boyfriend in their remarkably grungy Lower East Side apartment. April does not know how to cook, and worse yet, when she gets the turkey halfway prepared, she puts it in the oven only to realize her oven doesn't work.
Oh, boy. Who hasn't done that?
That happens all the time.
Well, and her mom sounds just despicable.
Her mom, whose name is Joy, of all things, played by Patricia Clarkson, is dying from breast cancer. And unlike the sorts of cancer patients we normally see in movies who have this sort of joy of life and become these really tender human beings, she's this very, very brittle woman.
Well, and this sets up the plot device that the family might be angry with her, but she's dying, and so they're stuck. They can't say anything. All while April is trying to make that dinner, which is tough on so many families anyway.
When her oven fails, she has to then go door to door to each of her neighbors trying to find someone willing to allow her to use their oven so she can finish cooking this turkey.
Hi, I have a problem.
Hey, who is it?
It's the new girl, 3C, says she's got a problem.
What?
Problems, Eugene. The girl's got problems. She's white. She got her youth, her whole privileged life ahead of her. I am looking forward to hearing about her problems.
Peter Hedges, the director of the film, is better known as a writer. He wrote the screenplay for About a Boy and What's Eating Gilbert Grape. How does it come across as a directorial debut?
It's a strangely shot film. It looks like a very, very cheaply made home movie.
Well, let's talk about the casting, though. Patricia Clarkson, in particular, who plays the mother, she won a special acting prize for her role in this film, as well as in The Station Agent and All the Real Girls. And she seems to be the new festival gal.
she's a wonderful actress, and this is a really difficult role because she has to play this woman who would normally be a sympathetic character, but she plays her completely unsympathetically. There's a scene, which you'll hear soon, where she's in the car and it seems like she's about to have this big discussion with her family, and she's saying, you know, I have to have this talk with you about something, and it doesn't turn out the way people think it's going to be.
We need to discuss how each of you... Oh, God.
It's okay, sweetie.
How each of you, in your own way, is going to handle discarding food without letting our hostess know.
Please. Joy, really.
The film, as we've mentioned, also stars Katie Holmes, who was on Dawson's Creek, and has Sean Hayes from Will and Grace. How did they transfer to the big screen from TV?
Katie Holmes is sort of an interesting case. She's done some interesting films. She was in Wonder Boys with Michael Douglas and Robert Downey Jr. She was in The Ice Storm, Ang Lee's film. I think she's interesting because she went from being this kind of teen queen to sort of really moving away from those sorts of roles on the big screen. I just think she's really a compelling young actress. Sean Hayes, who plays the swishy Jack on Will and Grace, plays a swishy character named Wayne in Pieces of April.
Is he appealing in the movie?
No. On Will and Grace, he's sort of like the fun queen, and this, he's sort of like the strange, bizarre queen.
It sounds like a difficult film for people to go see.
It's a strange film. I mean, it's always interesting to me how many filmmakers find Thanksgiving so fascinating. I mean, I guess for me, because of the whole gift-giving thing, I always think of Christmas as being the more troublesome holiday.
So there are some people for whom that's appealing, but overall, would you say this Thanksgiving film is, pardon me, well done?
Not for me. It's a little undercooked. You know, it has some interesting performances, but I'm not really sure it holds up, and it tries to neaten things up a little too much at the end. Mm.
Renee Graham, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Here now, film critic Renee Graham writes about pop culture for the Boston Globe.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
President Bush is in Asia with a UN resolution under his belt. Will it help him there and in the heartland?
And a comedian diagnosed with MS tries to find something to laugh about.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.